Podcast, Sunday, October 28th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it has been another crazy week for us Mac Geeks, us Mac fans. Apple announcing another plethora of new products. The iPad Mini, of course, along with a bunch of different Macs. We saw some Mac updates. A lot of the stuff was rumored. We talked about on the show the past month or so, and so there weren't a ton of surprises other than one for me, and that in the form of an update to the new iPad. Shocking for a few people, upsetting for a few people. We're going to talk about that, all of Apple's latest new products and announcements, along with a bunch of other goodies. Got some great feedback from you and some tips and tricks. We'll try and help you out with some of your Mac problems. But before we get into all of that, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Citrix. You know, when you're working with teams of people, it can be difficult sometimes to get on the same page, especially if your team is spread out, if you're in different offices, different cities, maybe even different countries. That task can be almost impossible in some cases. And you can try and use emails and texts, and that might work, but you know, those can be misread, and sometimes worse, your messages don't get read at all. They get lost in the shuffle. And so that's why I believe that meeting face to face is often necessary in order to be effective, in order to communicate your plans and ideas. It just helps to see each other face-to-face, and that's where GoToMeeting with HD Faces comes in. It provides you with a very simple yet powerful tool to collaborate online, and it makes it so much easier for everyone to get on the same page regardless of where they are, and also regardless of what kind of technology they have. It could be a Mac, a PC, an iOS device, an Android device. It all works with GoToMeeting, and it's also non-technical. It's really easy to get a meeting set up, to get somebody invited. You send them a link and they can join in to your meeting, and you get to see faces. You can read body language. You can even share your screen so that everybody can stay informed. They can follow along and they can stay on track. You know, I work from home. I work remotely, and so I have to collaborate with a lot of people, and this is a tool that I can employ to help do business effectively and efficiently, and that's really important. And you can try it free for yourself for 30 days. So don't wait. Just visit gotomeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and be sure to use the promo code MACCAST, and I think you're really going to love it. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. You likely know by now that Apple gave us a bunch of new products on Tuesday. They had their We Have a Little More to Show You event. And as everyone was expecting, they did finally announce the iPad Mini. They also announced a bunch of new Macs, including a Mac Mini, an iMac, and the new 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro. Let's start off with the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro. That had been rumored for a while, and we'd been waiting for Apple to finally drop that announcement on us. Well, they did. It's 0.75 inches thin. That's 20% thinner than the non-Retina 13-inch MacBook Pro, which Apple is continuing to sell. The Retina display model features an Intel dual-core i5 or i7 processor with Intel HD 4000 graphics. To get it that thin, of course, it is all flash-based in terms of the storage, so no spindle hard drive. You can get flash storage up to 768 gigabytes. It has a FaceTime HD camera, the new MagSafe 2 connector, two Thunderbolt ports, two USB 3 ports, HDMI, SDXC card slot, and a headphone jack, along with dual built-in mics, but no audio in anymore on the Retina model. So a nice complement of ports there. It is available now. The base model is $1,699 US. That's for a dual-core 2.5 gigahertz i5 processor, 8 gigabytes of RAM, and a 128 gigabyte flash storage, or 128 gigabytes of flash storage, excuse me. $19.99 for a dual core 2.5 gigahertz i5, 8 gigabytes of RAM, and 256 gigabytes of flash storage. So double the flash storage for about $300 more. Of course, there's build to order and configure your own options that you can get through Apple's website. And, you know, my take on it was looking at the three different versions now that Apple has of 13-inch notebooks, your buying decision really starts to become more about the features and the functionality that you want and not so much about the amount you want to spend. Well, it comes down to how much do you want to spend, but then for that price point, you have sort of three different choices in the 13-inch lineup, which I think is an interesting dilemma maybe for consumers. You know, you have things like the 13-inch MacBook Air that's all about portability with compromises maybe a little bit on the processor and especially on the ports that you're going to get. But if all you care about is light and thin, you might want to go with the 13-inch MacBook Air. If you want to kind of have a balance of things and you want to have that new gorgeous 13-inch Retina display, well, then the Retina MacBook Pro is probably the model for you. It kind of is light and portable. It has the flash storage, a little more performance, that great Retina display, and a few more ports. And then for the person who just needs to have a lot of legacy support, wants to have a lot of ports, needs a little more storage for the money, maybe a little more upgradability, you have the 13-inch non-Retina MacBook Pro still, which you can get a traditional hard drive in, so you're going to get, you know, 500 gigs, terabyte of storage in there. You get extra ports like Ethernet port, FireWire port, and if you still need a SuperDrive, that's going to be your only model choice. So you can buy any one of those across the line, configure them with sort of similar processors and memory. The 13-inch MacBook Air only goes up to a dual-core 2.0 gigahertz processor, I believe. But you can get them all pretty close to each other and get them pretty close in price range. And then really your choices is about, you know, what are you going to do with it and how much portability do you need and do you really need that or want, I guess in most cases, that Retina display. And a lot of people are going to opt for that option. So it's a nice addition to the lineup, I think. Then Apple also did an update to the Mac Mini, which was long overdue. It features new processors, including a dual-core Intel i5 running at 2.5 gigahertz or a quad-core Intel i7 running at 2.6 gigahertz. They also updated the graphics to the Intel HD 4000 graphics. You have hard drive options, 500 gigabyte or 1 terabyte hard drives running at 5,400 RPMs. You also have a build-to-order option featuring Apple's new Fusion Drive. That's a 1 terabyte version of the Fusion Drive. We'll talk about that in a second when we get to the iMacs, exactly what that is and what that means. 4 gigabytes of RAM standard, but upgradable to 16 gigabytes. It has two slots. Still comes with a really nice complement of ports, gigabit Ethernet, FireWire 800, HDMI out, Thunderbolt, 4 USB 3 ports, so upgraded to USB 3, SDXC card slot, and optical audio in and out. Also, 802.11n Wi-Fi and Bluetooth 4.0. They are available now, so a really nice bump up on the Mac Minis. Pricing remains the same. They also still have the server model, so you have a lot of choices there and a lot of configuration options. And I'm very happy to see the Mac Mini continue on because I think it's a great price point at $599 starting US and a good option for consumers looking for a budget Mac that really doesn't have a lot of compromises in terms of performance and power for most users. So I think it's a really good choice. I'm actually, you know, in the market eventually in the next year or two for a new desktop Mac, and it's going to be a hard choice between the Mac Mini and the iMac. I have an iMac now, and we'll have to see where we end up. But I started playing around again with the configurations, and what I'm finding is that, once again, the form factor really comes into play more than the price point. You can really configure a Mac Mini with some of the customization options very similarly to an iMac. Of course, you don't get the built-in screen and it's not a Mac display. You're going to have to go with a third-party display that's maybe a little bit cheaper, but you can end up saving a few hundred bucks and get a very comparable desktop system. So starting to become an interesting choice for consumers. And I'm starting to really think a lot about how do you recommend or tell somebody you should go with this Mac versus another Mac when you can actually sort of get them close to each other. And once again, I think what I'm finding is comes down to how are you going to use it and what sort of form factor are you interested in. It's not so much about how much RAM do you get or what the processor is, because those things can be all sort of made the same at the same price point, at least from the playing around I've done on Apple's website. We don't have the build-to-order configuration options on the iMac yet, so we'll have to see if that holds true with these new models. And so speaking of that, Apple did release an updated version of the iMac. It has a new design, very thin at the edge, just 5 millimeters. Apple was sort of showing off how thin it was. They were creative on the website about showing it only from specific angles. And even during the announcement, Phil Schiller unveiled it and sort of turned it side profile to the audience. But he was very specific about how he showed it to them, because there is a nice little bump on the back. In looking at Apple's website, it seems like it's similar to the curve that's on the 2009 iMac, although because it's so thin on the edge and in the front, it almost dramatically looks bigger, like it's got this big hump back on it. But it's there to accommodate a standard hard drive, which you can still get in the iMac model. Interestingly, it's a lot lighter, about 8 pounds lighter, according to what Phil Schiller was saying during the announcement. It is not a Retina screen. Some people were hoping that the iMac would see a Retina update. I still think putting Retina on a screen that large, 27-inch or 21-inch, those are still the two standard sizes, that would be a bit much, and I think you'd have some serious production problems. I'm not sure there's anybody making Retina level panels at those sizes yet. But the screen resolutions are 2560 by 1640 for the 17-inch, or for the 27-inch, excuse me, and 1920 by 1080 for the 21.5-inch model. To get it thinner, the display is now laminated to the glass, which makes it thinner. Also should help with the clarity, because you don't have that separation, so should be a little bit crisper. And they also are applying a new anti-glare coating that, according to Apple, makes it 75% less reflective. So that's good news. You know, with those glossy screens at certain angles and in certain lighting conditions, that glare can really be a factor. So anytime they can reduce that more, that's good. No optical drive. I think that wasn't surprising. Apple's been moving away from optical drives across the board, but it's finally official in the iMac. They are offering an external option, so you can get a USB optical drive if you still need a super drive. NVIDIA GeForce GT or GTX graphics, and the option to upgrade to the new Fusion drive. So let's talk a little bit about what that is. The Fusion drive is 128 gigabytes of flash combined with either a 1 terabyte or 3 terabyte traditional hard drive. And this is an interesting product because a lot of people immediately start to think about something like Seagate's hybrid drives, which have a little bit of flash storage, usually about 8 gigabytes, and almost more work like a sort of caching system. In the case of the Fusion drive, Apple's done something a little bit different. You actually have a true 128 gigabytes of flash storage and then the terabyte or 3 terabyte hard drive, but to the operating system, they appear as one drive. And then when you hear that, you immediately think, well, then it must be just like a striped RAID, right? Well, it's actually not RAID at all. The Finder and applications do see it as a single contiguous drive, but if you go into Disk Utility, you'd actually see the separate volumes. And it's Mountain Lion, the operating system itself, that actually marries them together. So it's all handled at the OS level. And then what also happens at the OS level is it watches to see what applications and documents you are using most frequently and then dynamically copies them over to the flash portion of the storage. And this all happens automagically. So you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to think about it. The operating system is constantly watching and moving stuff over so that the stuff that you're accessing most frequently is always on the fastest storage. And so that should vastly increase performance. Another thing that I read that it does is all of your writes when you're working on applications, all the writes happen to the flash storage first, and then stuff gets moved over depending upon whether you're actively using it or opening those files or documents. So it sounds like a really cool technology. And as far as pricing goes, what it's going to cost on the build-to-order options, we don't know for sure on the iMacs, but in the Mac Mini, it's a $250 upgrade to add a 1 terabyte Fusion drive. So it's not cheap, but when you consider you're getting 128 gigs of flash storage, that's a pretty good price. And I would expect the pricing to be very similar on the iMac. We'll have to wait and see how much the 3 gigabyte Fusion drive is, but seems like a really cool technology, and it'll be interesting to see when the benchmarks start coming out how it performs and how it compares to a traditional hard drive. And also, I'd be curious to see how it compares to the Seagate hybrid drives. But all of the iMacs do come with standard traditional spindle-based hard drives. Also, 8 gigabytes of RAM standard on the iMac. An interesting thing is Boy Genius reports is saying that the RAM on the 21.5-inch model is no longer consumer upgradable, but I guess maybe the 27-inch model still is. I haven't heard confirmation on that, and that's the only place I saw that reported. But if that is the case, if you're considering buying a 21-inch iMac, you're probably going to want to configure it build to order with the full amount of RAM that you want. So if you want 16 gigabytes, you're going to want to order it that way. Good complement of ports and things also on the new iMacs: FaceTime HD camera, gigabit Ethernet, 2 Thunderbolt ports, 4 USB 3 ports, the SDXC card slot, which is on the back, so can be a little bit tricky to access, but still there. Headphone, and again, dual mics that are built in, not audio in. So hooking up mics and audio in devices is going to require getting a USB adapter to make that happen. Pricing on the units starting at $1,299 US for the 21-inch model with a 2.7 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5 processor, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 1 terabyte hard drive, and an NVIDIA GeForce GT640M. There's also a $1,499 model of the 21-inch. That gets you a 2.9 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 1 terabyte hard drive, and an NVIDIA GeForce GT650M GPU. Then you jump up to the 27-inch model. Those start at $1,799 US, 2.9 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 1 terabyte hard drive, and an NVIDIA GeForce GT660M. And then the high-end pre-configured 27-inch model is $1,999 US. That's for a 3.2 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 1 terabyte hard drive, and an NVIDIA GeForce GT675MX graphics processor. And the 21-inch model is going to be shipping in November. The 27-inch models aren't going to arrive until December. So you have a little bit of a wait on the iMac, especially if you want the 27-inch model, but a really nice update to the iMac. And that was all of the updates that Apple had for their Macs. After that, they moved on to the iPads, starting not with the iPad mini, but actually with a new version of the new iPad. So we now have a new iPad. Apple actually seems to be officially calling it the iPad with Retina display, the fourth generation of the iPad. There were basically three big updates to this. They added a new processor, the A6X, which, according to Apple, doubles the CPU and GPU performance. It's got quad-core graphics. Ars Technica made some pretty good guesses as to what the actual specs might be. They believe Apple is using 2 A6 ARM cores running at 1.5 gigahertz with 4 PowerVR SGX 543 cores running at 500 megahertz on the graphics side. So very capable new processor in the updated iPad. It also gains wider LTE support, so wider 4G LTE. If you remember when the new iPad came out, Apple said it was 4G with LTE and quickly had to sort of backtrack on that a little bit when they found out it was really only supported in North America. Internationally, it wasn't really supporting all the carrier networks. Now it seems to be similar to the iPhone 5, so it's going to be LTE available in many more countries. So that was really good news. And then the other big update, Apple moving from the 30-pin dock connector to their new Lightning connector. So they're moving now across the board all of their iOS devices over to Lightning. And I think that was a big part of this iPad revision, was to get everything standardized on that new Lightning connector. As far as pricing, that's remaining the same. It went on sale for pre-orders on October 26th and will be shipping on November 2nd. Almost immediately, you started to hear rumblings, though, of are people going to be upset, purchasers of the current third-generation iPad, the new iPad, since it's only been out for about 7 to 8 months. And my personal take on that is I didn't think so, but then there was a poll. I was reading some things. A couple people did polls, and one of the polls came out and said about 50% of iPad 3 owners are upset about the upgrade happening so soon after the release of the new iPad. There was also reports that on sites like Gazelle that offer cash for your old devices, they saw an immediate increase, about a 700% increase of people putting in to resell their third generation iPads. So seems like a lot of people want to upgrade to the new model. My take on it is that it's really a nice rev for this new version of the iPad, but it's nothing really truly earth-shattering. I don't necessarily know that people are going to really see a lot of the performance or the speed increases. It's nice to have the Lightning connector, but in some ways it's not, because if you have accessories that already work with the 30-pin dock, it might be nicer to have the older model. And Apple is continuing to sell the iPad 2. Looks like they are going to discontinue and replace the new iPad, the third-generation iPad, with this fourth-generation model. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. If you did very recently purchase a new iPad, you might want to consider contacting Apple. It's sounding like Apple's extending their normal 14-day return window out to almost 30 days in some cases. I think it's happening on a case-by-case basis, but if your new iPad is in fairly good condition and you've purchased it within the last 30 days, it sounds like you might be able to take it back to the Apple Store and get the new model. So that's good news for those folks, and might soften the blow a little bit for those who are upset about the upgrade happening so soon. And then lastly, the big announcement at the event, the iPad mini is now here. It features a 7.9-inch screen, but interestingly, dimensionally, it is actually smaller and lighter than other 7-inch tablets that are on the market. If you look at it, you'll notice it has a much narrower bezel. And I remember when they first showed it during the event, I thought immediately, well, how are you going to hold that thing? Well, it turns out that iOS reportedly has been tweaked a little bit, iOS 6, so that it will reject any kind of hold touches that happen on the edge of the screen. We'll have to see how well that works once we get them. I do have mine on order. I ordered it on Friday when pre-orders went on sale, and I expect to get it on the 2nd, so I'll give you all my thoughts and opinions once I get it and have a little time to play around with it. The processor is a dual-core A5. The screen resolution, it is not a Retina display. It's actually running at the same resolution as the iPad 2, 1024 by 768. That gives it a pixel density of 163 pixels per inch. Apple did a hands-on during the event, and a number of the reporters who got to take a look at it said, even though it's not a Retina display, it still looks very nice. It's crisp and very sharp, so I think just the reduced size and being at that resolution helps with that sort of thing. It has two cameras. The FaceTime HD camera is 1.3 megapixels, and then the rear EyeSight camera is 5 megapixels, so really nice cameras on the iPad mini. Of course, the Lightning connector, Apple again standardizing on that. 10 hours of battery life, all aluminum and glass design, actually using the same design cues as the new iPhone 5. So there's a white and silver model, also a black and slate model. And they both feature that chamfered edge just like the iPhone 5. Pre-orders did start on Friday, and they are shipping November 2nd, although you would have had to get your order in for a white one early. I accidentally fell asleep. I was planning to be up at midnight. This was going to be the first time I was going to order a white iOS device. I've always ordered black, but because of some of the issues I had with my black iPhone, I am concerned a little bit about scratching, particularly on that chamfered edge. I was hoping to order a white one. I woke up about 4 a.m. Pacific time, and they were already sold out. I read reports that within just a few minutes, something like 26 or in the first 30 minutes, they had sold out of the white models, at least the 16 gigabyte version. And very quickly, they were completely sold out of the white model. Luckily, they still had black models available, so I got a black 16 gigabyte model. Pricing starts at $329. A lot of people were really hoping Apple would get into that sub $299 range. They didn't, although it's been reported that this is the lowest profit margin Apple is going to be earning on any iOS device. iPads have typically been a lower profit margin for Apple. This one is supposedly the lowest, but I think it still falls in that 40% range, maybe 30% from what I've been reading. We'll have to find out after they've done a teardown exactly what all those component parts are. But Apple's saying they were never focused on making a low-priced mini tablet, that they were really just focused on making the best mini tablet they could make, and they landed at that $329 price point for the 16-gigabyte Wi-Fi model. And then it follows along with typical iPad pricing, where each successive jump in storage adds another $100. So $429 for the 32-gigabyte and $529 for the 16-gigabyte Wi-Fi model. The Wi-Fi models are coming out first, so those are the ones that'll be here on November 2nd. They also have LTE models available, although I'm reading reports that those will not ship to customers until November 21st at the earliest, and they follow the same pricing conventions as well that Apple has used on prior iPad models, adding another $130 to the base prices for the Wi-Fi only versions. So $459 US for the 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi plus cellular, $559 for the 32 gigabyte, and $659 for the 64 gigabyte. So the iPad mini looks impressive. It's going to be great to get my hands on it and see how it performs, see how it compares. And I will give you all of my thoughts and opinions on a future episode of the MacCast. There was one smaller update that Apple made that I did not notice and didn't see until after the event. The news reports started coming out that Apple also updated their wall charger. The original version of the wall charger was a 5-watt charger. That was the one with the original iPad, with older iPhones, with the iPad 2, I think it was. They updated that to a 10-watt wall charger, and now they've upgraded it again to 12 watts, and that will work with the second generation and newer iPads, as well as, I would assume, the iPad mini, the iPhone 4S and 5, and the iPod Nano 7th generation, as well as the 5th generation iPod Touch. And what the additional wattage will give you is just faster charging times. So now we can get our iOS devices back up and running when we've run them down even quicker. So new juice for your iThingies. And that was all of the announcements that Apple had. Well, I guess not quite all of the announcements. That was all the announcements from that event. But just a couple days later, Apple did announce the quarterly results for their fourth quarter of 2012. And what has been a continuous trend for many years, they announced record revenue of $36 billion and a net profit of $8.2 billion for the quarter. It was Apple's best September revenue and earnings ever, with revenue up 27% and profits up 24% over the same period a year ago. Even though Apple's sales were $35.8 billion, which beat analysts' estimates, the earnings per share came in at $7.56, which fell below expectations of $8.75. On the iPad front, Apple sold 14 million iPads, which is also a record for the September quarter and an increase of 26%, but still below analysts' expectations. Mac sales were relatively flat. Apple said they sold 4.9 million for the quarter, which was just a 1% increase over last year, but still beats the PC industry as a whole, which is reportedly down 8% on average for the quarter. And not surprisingly, iPod sales continue to dwindle. Apple sold 5.3 million iPods, which doesn't sound like dwindling to me, but actually represents about a 19% year-over-year decline in iPod sales. One surprising announcement was that the Apple TV, which Apple continues to say is just a hobby, actually saw its unit sales double, with Apple saying they sold 1.3 million units for the quarter. So Mac and iPad sales were okay, but not great. I have a feeling, though, that the first quarter for Apple coming up is going to be huge with the new desktop Macs, which haven't seen refreshes in a while, and with the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro being in there. I think, you know, there were a number of people that were hearing rumors, and that maybe gave consumers some pause to wait a little bit and see what was going to happen. So now we're moving into the new quarter. We've got all those new models of Macs sitting there ready for holiday sales, and I think it's going to jump Apple's numbers extremely. You also got all the new iPod lineup. I mean, just across the board, Apple has fully stocked their stores for the end of the year, and I think that's going to result in really, really big numbers. On the iPad side, I would imagine the same sort of thing happened. We'd been hearing rumors about new iPads coming, this new iPad mini, so I think a lot of consumers were maybe waiting to see what was going to happen before they pulled the trigger on a new iPad purchase, and now they're going to move forward with those. Whether it ends up being an iPad mini or the new fourth generation iPad, they have a lot of choice, and I think that is only going to result in great numbers for Apple in the next quarter. So they had record sales for this quarter. It wasn't down, but analysts were a little bit disappointed overall by the numbers, and especially, as I mentioned, by the lower than expected revenue per share numbers. That being said, I think it's only analysts that could call having a record quarter and selling that many iOS devices and Macs disappointing. I think it was very, very good across the board. And one little surprising comment that came out of the Q&A after the event, something that I thought was a little bit funny, was that Tim Cook reaffirmed that Apple would not make a 7-inch tablet, pointing out once again that the iPad mini is really a 7.9-inch tablet with a 35% larger display. And somehow, I'm not sure how this translates, 50 to 60% more usable area. So I guess doing the math there in terms of total square inches or square millimeters, however they do that, this is not a 7-inch tablet, even though it is 7.9 inches. So it seems to be a little bit splitting hairs. The physical dimension size smaller than most 7-inch tablets. So I think it's all about screen size as far as Tim Cook is concerned. And so, as I said, analysts were a little bit disappointed with those iPad numbers. As a matter of fact, Strategy Analytics announced the latest numbers for Q3 2012 tablet sales, and they claim that Apple did ship a disappointing number of 14 million tablets for the third quarter. Again, I don't know how these analysts do it. Apple sold 14 million tablets, but that ends up being disappointing. And it's because they're comparing, you know, gains year over year. So that resulted in just a 3% gain over the same period last year. And while Apple's unit shipment gains were modest, Android tablets saw their year-over-year unit sales double from about 5 million in the Q3 2012 to just over 10 million this year. So when you take Apple's gains compared to the Android tablet gains, it does look a little bit disappointing. Net result of all of that means that Apple showed overall tablet market share drop of 7%, moving from 64% last year to 57% this year. So they lost a little bit in terms of tablet market share to the Android devices. But I really don't find that surprising, because Android tablets have been very aggressive. You've got the Google Nexus out there. You've got the Kindle Fire, technically an Android tablet. So it also depends on what you're defining as an Android tablet. If you're talking about Google Android tablets, the numbers might shake out very differently. But another interesting thing from the Strategy Analytics report was that global tablet shipments grew just 43% annually for the third quarter of 2012. And while that might sound like a really good number, if you compare that to third quarter of 2011, there was an annual percentage increase of 289%. So tablets, in terms of overall gains year over year, are coming way, way down. I'm not sure what that means. I think it just means that the product market is becoming more mature. I don't think it's any scarier. It's just that there was a nascent tablet market in 2010, so it was easy to jump to huge numbers percentage-wise in 2011. And now that it's a little more mature, there's more tablets on the market, even though I bet unit-wise, more being sold across the board, it results in a net smaller percentage gain year over year. And then as far as another reason why Apple's year over year numbers might be a little bit lower, you know, Apple launched the new iPad less than a year ago, so I think sales have naturally slowed a bit. And with Apple launching new devices and targeting that premium 7-inch tablet space with the iPad mini, I think it's going to be more interesting to see how the Q4 share numbers end up shaking out. And I have a feeling they might move back in Apple's favor in terms of overall percentage of market share versus Android tablets. But we're just going to have to wait to see how those numbers come out. Bloomberg is reporting something that we've heard before, that Apple is planning to launch some sort of streaming music service soon. The interesting thing this time around, though, is the rumors seem to indicate it will be a streaming radio service, something along the lines of Pandora. They say that deals with the record labels are involving some sort of revenue ad share thing to go along with the music licensing deal. And at this point, that's sort of the sticking point, is sort of how much ad revenue and how much ad sharing revenue is Apple going to give to the labels. Apple, for its part, might be looking to extend its struggling iAd business to include audio ads, and a streaming radio type service would help out with that. Analyst Richard Greenfield thinks that Apple may be looking to capitalize on the 2 hours a day that people spend in the car listening to terrestrial radio, so that would give them an opportunity to take advantage of that. People already have their iOS devices in the car with them, so getting them to move away from the radio onto some sort of Apple-based service could help them, especially in the ad arena. So the advertising piece of it might be one reason why we're hearing this rumor shift from just a true, pure streaming music service to something that's a little more like a radio-based service. The Bloomberg piece also claims that Apple wants listeners to be able to buy tracks as music streams or come back and revisit what they heard in auto-generated playlists. So sounding a lot more like sort of Pandora-style thing where you get these generated playlists. I don't know if it means Apple would generate them or if you would, like Pandora, sort of recommend a style of music or a genre of music that you want to hear, sort of tune into that iTunes channel and then be able to come back and make purchases of those tracks based on what you heard. I would imagine there's going to be really tight integration with the iTunes store and the ability to buy music. This is a really interesting shift in how this rumor has been shaking out. And I think a lot of people were really hoping for more of a music-based service where you would subscribe and you get access to anything that is in the iTunes store to be able to stream that. You just don't own it. As long as you continue to pay, you sort of rent your music. Apple's never been really keen on that, at least publicly. And so it was always a little weird when we were hearing those rumors that that was the direction Apple might be going in. So to me, this one makes a little more sense, but I think it'll be interesting to see how consumers react to it because, you know, you have things out there like Spotify that I think gives you a little bit more control over the actual music that you can hear. Who knows if it'll be some sort of hybrid between Spotify and something like a Pandora. We're just going to have to wait and see if this rumor does come true. But we are starting to hear more and more about it in the past week, that Apple is revisiting or getting closer to realizing some sort of streaming service related to iTunes. And then finally in the news for this week, some not so great news for those of you in Euro-based countries. It looks like Apple has raised the minimum price that developers are allowed to charge for their apps in those regions. The pricing was reportedly raised from 79 euro cents to 89 euro cents, and I guess that translates to about $1.15 US, so a little bit above that 99 cent price point that we have for apps over here in the States. Apple's developer terms of service reportedly allow for adjustments in the pricing tiers, and Apple says that the changes are to account for changes in currency exchange rates. Interestingly, and also probably disappointingly for some developers, it looks like the adjustment also appears to impact the standard 30-70% split that Apple shares with developers, with developers in Euro regions reportedly getting 61% of Euro-based sales and Apple keeping the rest of the money. So I'll be the first to admit that I don't fully understand the economics and exchange rates of all this stuff, but to me that sounds like a not so great deal for consumers and probably not a very good deal for the developers either. And with that bit of news, I wish it was a little bit more positive. That's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies. You know, every once in a while you find one of those great applications for your Mac that you pick up for one reason and then find yourself using for more and more things. And that's been the case for me with Notebook. I think I picked it up originally to take notes, which is the likely thing you'd think to use an application called Notebook for. But I think once you have it, you'll find you can use it for all sorts of things. So, of course, it's great at taking notes and doing outlines, but you can also use it to organize projects. You can use it for doing research. You can create lists and to-dos, create org charts and workflows because it's got great sets of drawing tools. You can also plan events and vacations and just do just about anything that you would do in real life with a physical notebook. And just like with a physical notebook, you'll find yourself using it for lots of different things. And what I think is really powerful about it is it keeps everything related to a project or something that you're working on all in one place and makes it easy to go back and find that stuff and reference it because it's got powerful searching tools. It's got a great indexing system with the multi-dex. So it indexes all of your information in all kinds of different ways. One of my favorite ones is pulling out all the links within a notebook so you can go to one page and see all of the URLs that are referenced. You have flags and sticky notes to help you organize. You have links back to information that is in context. So if you've thrown in a hyperlink, you can go back and find the original web page. If you've pulled in something from an email, you can get information out of that email, like the sender's email address, or go back to the original email in your mail application. And you can do the same sorts of things for stuff pulled in from calendars and events and stuff like that. So it's a really powerful tool, and it's one of those apps that I think you'll always want to have around on your Mac. And you can even try it out free for 30 days so you can see all this stuff for yourself. Get more information and details as well as find that free trial over on circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. I received an email this week from Al, and he's been working on trying to go paperless and trying to get his workflow together. And he asked me about a way to convert mail messages into PDF files so that he could put them into his paperless system for archiving. And he was specifically wondering about using an automator script to help that process along. And I started to look into it a little bit, and there just didn't seem to be a way, at least that I could figure out, with Automator to do what he was looking for. I think you possibly, Al, could use some Apple script or something like that, but I think there may be an easier way, because as I was doing my research, I found out that if you just simply go into the mail application and select multiple messages from the mail list, you can go up to the file menu, choose print, and then use the save to PDF option, and it will save out all of the selected messages as PDFs. One thing to note when you use this feature, I was playing around with it a little bit, is that it will give them all the same file name, appending a dash and a number to each successive message. So if you've selected 10 messages, you get the save as dialog box. When you choose the save as PDF option, you enter a file name, and then it will just increment those. So it'll, you know, if you said saved emails, you'd have saved email 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So I hope that makes sense. But at least you can save them out as PDFs. You might need to do a little bit of renaming after the fact. And another little gotcha in using this feature is that if you read your messages in the conversation view in Lion, that's the thing that sort of pulls in not only the messages that you received, but also your replies in context, so your sent messages. It's only going to print out the received messages. It doesn't go through the sent mailbox and actually print out the stuff in the conversation thread. So you're going to have to go in and pull those out separately if you want to save those out as well. And here's a little trick that will make this whole process go a little bit quicker from David Sparks, who actually literally wrote the book on paperless. He has a great post on his blog, and I'll link to it in the show notes at macast.com. But he has a great piece on how to add a keyboard shortcut to the print to PDF option. So normally, you'd have to bring up the print dialog box and then click the little drop down for save as PDF to get to the print to PDF option. With David's tip, what you can do is you can create the shortcut by going into System Preferences, going to the Keyboard and Mouse settings, and going to the Keyboard Shortcuts tab, then clicking on the little plus symbol and adding a new shortcut for all applications. And then the trick is to type in the command exactly as it appears in that Save as PDF dropdown. So you want to type out Save as PDF. And I made the mistake of using a capital A in the as. That's not how it's printed in the menu. So look at the drop-down menu and see specifically how it's printed out. You have to type it exactly like that, including adding the little ellipsis at the end. So to type that, for those of you who don't know, it's option plus semicolon. You can't just type three periods. You actually have to type that special ellipsis symbol. So enter that into the command field, and then put in your keyboard shortcut. You can use command P, which normally would be the same thing to bring up the print sheet, but and it would seem like a conflict, but in this case, it actually isn't, because what you're going to do is you're going to hit command P to bring up the sheet first, the print sheet, and then when you hit command P again, it will activate your keyboard shortcut. So you can go ahead and hit enter command P as the keyboard shortcut for this as well, and then click the add button, and then you're done. So now in any application, when you want to print to a PDF, and this would work for the mail application for you as well, Al, all you have to do is hit command P, bring up the print sheet, and then hit command P again, and then you can save out your documents as PDFs. So I thought that was a really great little trick, and didn't even know that was possible until I did this research. And it's from our friend David Sparks, who you've probably heard on the MacCast before. So if you want to get more information about paperless, you should check out his book, Paperless, which is available on the iBookstore for your iPad. You can also get it from his website. Go to MacSparky.com, and he has PDF versions available if you're on Android or want to get it on a different platform or on your Mac. So check all that out, MacSparky.com. And Al, I hope that helps you out with your process of going paperless. Next up, I have a question that came in on the MacCast hotline, and this one's from Jay. Unfortunately, Jay's having a little bit of trouble with accessing his purchased applications on the App Store.
Hi, Adam. My name is Jay from St. Louis, Missouri. And first off, I'm a big fan of yours. I've been listening to you for many years, and you put on a great show, so thank you for that. The reason I'm calling is ever since I upgraded to iOS 6 and any of my iPhones that my iTunes account is plugged into, I cannot access purchases. When I go to click on purchases, it spins for a while and then crashes to the home screen. Now, if I plug into any iPad or Mac device, I can look up purchases. But if I log into any iPhone, including demo versions or friends' iPhones, if I plug in my iTunes account, it crashes when it goes to purchases. Now, I have a 4S that I use myself, my wife's 3GS, and an old 3GS that I gave to my son as a gaming device. All of them do that. I've gone to the Apple Genius Bar twice and talked to AppleCare for over an hour and spoke with iTunes through chat. None of them seem to have an answer, so if anybody out there knows what I could do, because it's kind of frustrating. And again, I really appreciate the show, and thank you so much, and you have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Jay, for listening, and thank you for the question. That is extremely frustrating. I can only imagine how irritating that must actually be, and I'm going to give you a couple suggestions, some ideas, but unfortunately, I think that they might not help, because as I was doing research for this, I discovered there's a 12-page Apple support thread with 176 replies on this issue on Apple's discussion boards. So I'll have a link to that for you in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to go read through there. But I kind of parsed through it a little bit, and it looks like there really isn't a fix for the people that are in there. There's a lot of suggestions of fixes, but nothing. Some seem to work for some people, but nothing conclusive. One theory that seems to be running through the thread, though, is that it might have something to do with the number of applications that you have installed on your device or you actually have purchased. I personally have 279. I checked on my iPhone, and I have not had an issue updating, but there were other reports in that thread of people having 500 or more applications, if not thousands of applications, and it may be that it's just too much for the update system, or the purchased system, rather, to handle. And one user has suggested simply going through and hiding applications so that they don't show up in the purchased applications list on your iOS device. And some of you may or may not know that this is even possible. It was something that you could do up until iOS 6 on your iOS device itself. So you could go into that purchased list, which I know in your case, Jay, you can't access right now. But let's say you could and you were still running iOS 5, you could go in there and you could slide your finger across an application and you'd get a little hide button. That seems to have been taken away with iOS 6, but you still can do it from iTunes, and specifically from the iTunes store. So if you go into the iTunes store within iTunes and go to the app purchases list, which is the link over on the right, I think it's just called purchased, you can go in there and you can click on the applications tab, and then you'll see all your applications listed. If you hover over them, you'll get the little X icon, like you'd be closing the application. In the iTunes store, if you click on that, it will ask you if you want to hide the application. If you say okay, it will hide the application. And if you ever need to get back and unhide it, you can do that from your iTunes account area. So you go into the iTunes account area, there's a section called iTunes in the cloud, and you'll see a link that says to view hidden purchases. And if you click on that, you can go in and you can unhide your application. But the recommendation from this one person was go in, hide the applications that you don't need to see, and sort of reduce that list, reduce that number of applications that might show up when you try and access that purchase tab on your iOS device. And interestingly, this hiding feature works not just for applications, but also for movies and TV shows, books, also music. And I think the original intent was in case you shared an account with people, specifically probably your kids, there might be certain purchases that you don't want your kids to see, or maybe music that has explicit lyrics and maybe movies or TV shows that are of a higher rating than you may want other members of your family to have access to. So you can hide those things so they don't show up in their update list. But I have to half wonder if part of the issue might also be just the amount of free space that might be on your device. So another thing you may check is, how much extra storage do you have available? And you might try and clear off some space so that update has a little bit of room to work with. I don't know if that's a factor or not, but it seems to be, you know, something related to the number of applications, at least according to a lot of the people who are reporting on that thread. The only other thing I could think of is you probably could try what I call the universal fix for all of your iOS problems. You know, it's sort of like the equivalent of running repair permissions on your Mac, right? If something goes wrong with your iOS device, the fix is always to go into iTunes, connect your device, and do a restore. Although I'll tell you, many people in the thread report that even doing a restore for this issue didn't seem to fix the problem. Luckily, the people who are reporting it as having worked say that you can do a restore from backup. You don't have to do a restore and set up as new. I hate doing that because when you do that, you lose a lot of your data. So it's nice to be able to do a restore from backup, and that might address the issue. I don't know if you've tried that out already. Beyond that, I'm going to turn to you folks in the community. Do you have any ideas that could help Jay out? I'm not really sure. Maybe one of you have run into this issue and been able to resolve it. If you have, please send your email, maccast@gmail.com. Let me know what worked, and I'll try and pass that along to Jay. Jay, I hope maybe some of these fixes or maybe something in that thread helps fix your issue, because I know that could be extremely frustrating. For those of us who are looking to get a little more speed out of our Macs, maybe looking to purchase a new Mac and upgrade how fast things work, one of the big upgrades that a lot of people are recommending these days is moving to flash storage or a solid state drive. We've seen Apple doing it on their products across the board. They're moving more and more to flash storage. We've got these new Fusion drives that couple flash storage with a standard hard drive. Well, Daily this week wrote me to share his experience that was a little contradictory toward a lot of the reports that we hear, that, you know, all you have to do is get an SSD, solid state drive, throw it in your old Mac, and boom, your performance is going to increase exponentially, and everything's going to be a whole lot better, rainbows and kittens all around, and we absolutely love it. And he was saying that, you know, he purchased an OWC solid state drive for his 15-inch MacBook Pro, and while he saw performance gains, he didn't see the sort of performance increases that he was expecting. And he was saying many areas improved, but he had some issues with iPhoto, and then more specifically was having an issue with the Hibernate mode that suddenly wasn't working now that he had upgraded to an SSD in his Mac. And for those of you who don't know what Hibernate is or what I mean by that, it's a feature of the operating system that for notebooks allows the system to take the contents of RAM, of the memory, and write it to a portion of the hard drive. And why would you want to do that? Well, it's mainly to protect stuff that you are working on in case you run out of battery or you lose power. It's going to have that information that was in RAM. Anytime the Mac starts to go to sleep, it will take that and put that onto a portion of the hard drive. And some people don't like this feature, and actually there's tools out there that will allow you to go in and turn it off. I generally don't recommend doing that because I think it's pretty valuable, but sometimes when you have limited amount of space, of hard disk space, you know, if you have 8 gigabytes of memory, it's going to write 8 gigabytes of information every time your Mac goes to sleep onto your hard drive. So it'll eat up that space. But the idea is that when your Mac goes to sleep, especially if you're running on battery power and you're not able to plug in, anything that you are working on will actually get saved because it'll hold that portion of memory. And then when you're able to get plugged back into power and start your Mac back up, it can take what it's saved onto the hard disk and write that back into active memory, into the RAM, and you'll be back right up and running where you had left off. So it's a nice feature, but for Daily, it wasn't working when he upgraded to his OWC SSD. So he took the Mac into the Genius Bar, and the Genius told him that the Hibernate mode wasn't working because the OWC SSD wasn't using trim, or trim wasn't supported on that SSD drive. And that was something that is supported in Mac OS X. It was added in 10.6.8. and it's only supported on Apple installed solid state drives. And so what the genius did is he used a tool called Trim Enabler to try and enable trim support on the SSD drive for the Mac. This is a utility, a tool that allows you to use third-party SSD drives and take advantage of the trim support that's built into Mac OS X. There's actually also a terminal command that you can run to get this done. I'll have a link to Trim Enabler in the show notes at maccast.com. But I think in your case, Daly, the genius was confused, and I highly doubt that the lack of the ability to use OS X's built-in trim support with your SSD has anything to do with the Hibernate feature. And actually enabling the trim support might have actually caused a decrease in the performance of your OWC SSD. As a matter of fact, OWC has a blog post about why their drives don't use or have trim support. And basically the reason for it, I'll have a link to the blog post if you want to read the whole thing over on OWC's website. I'll have a link for that in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically it comes down to the fact that trim support is built into the OWC drives, or at least in a way it's built into the drives. And to explain that, I probably should explain to everybody what trim is and what it does, for those of you who aren't familiar with the term. Traditional hard drives, when you delete a file, the data is not actually deleted on the drive in most cases, unless you're doing a secure erase or a secure empty trash or something like that. What actually happens is the system, the operating system, just marks the blocks on the drive as usable by the system, saying you can overwrite these blocks because we're not using them anymore. But it actually doesn't delete the data, and that's actually part of the reason why hard drive recovery tools are able to work, because they can go back in and sort of rebuild that information and get the information back out, because it was never actually erased. It's not truly erased until it's overwritten by some other data. So at some point, because you've marked that as available space, when you're writing new files or installing new software or something like that, it will overwrite that data, and it's essentially then erased. With SSDs, though, performance is actually better when you're writing to unused or zeroed out blocks, basically empty space. So for best performance with a solid state drive, you want to be able to write to open available space. And what trim is designed to do, it's actually a command that gets run to do something called garbage collection, which means it's just going to go through and sweep the SSD drive for any items that have been deleted and then zero out those blocks, basically making them empty again, so that when you turn around and are writing back to the SSD drive, you get the fastest possible performance. So trim is really about adding performance. It has nothing to do, as far as I know, with the Hibernate feature. I guess part of Hibernate is writing that information from memory to the drive, so it might slow things down maybe when you're putting your Mac to sleep if you didn't have trim support on your SSD. But for OWC's SSDs, it really is a moot point, because they use a SandForce controller in the drives, and it actually performs the same function as trim support in the operating system would. It does the garbage collection, it actually zeroes out or erases, empties those blocks and makes them available. So if you look, when you have an OWC SSD drive installed in your Mac in the system information application, you'll notice that they say they don't have trim support, but it really is there in a way, because it's happening in the hardware itself actively as you're using the drive. So I don't think, Daly, you need to worry about that sort of thing. And you probably want to go back in to the trim enabler and re-disable trim support for your drive, and that might actually improve your performance. I don't know for 100% that's what's happening with your drive, but I have an inkling that that might be something worth looking into. So hope that helps anybody else who might have used trim enabler with an OWC SSD drive, and I hope it explains a little bit about how SSD and trim and the Hibernate feature in OS X work. Next up, I have an email that I received from John related to Java. He actually emailed me because he wanted to remove Java from his system, or at least disable it. But when he went in to try and access the Java Preferences app, it was no longer on his Mac. Normally, the Java Preferences can be found in the Applications folder under Utilities, and there's an application called Java Preferences if you have Java installed. And from there, you can go in and you can enable or disable the different versions of Java. Now, if you're running macOS 10.7, John, or later, and you ran the recent Java update 2012.006, which I think just came out a couple weeks ago or maybe about a week ago, it actually by design goes in and removes the Java Preferences app. And the reason is because the update installs the latest version of Java SE 6 and configures the web plugin to download Java 7 runtime from Oracle the next time an applet runs or needs to access Java. And the reason for that is Apple's been moving away from supplying their own installation of, or their own build of Java within macOS 10, and they're having consumers who need it go out to Oracle's website to download it. And actually, the operating system will take care of it for you. So if you have an application that needs Java and you don't have Java installed, it'll prompt you and ask you if you want to go out and download the version from Oracle. And so with this latest update, this Java 2012.006 update, it also updates the operating system to use the latest version of Java SE that is installed on the operating system. And the latest version offered by Oracle is Java SE 7. That's the version that can be downloaded directly from their website if you want to install it. And in that version, Oracle has its own Java Preferences system preference pane. So it has their own little control for Java. And Apple, therefore, chose to sort of prepare for that by removing their version of the little settings application, of the preferences application. And so even though Apple has removed their application for controlling the settings for Java, Java itself is still there and installed even if you run this update. As I mentioned earlier, Java SE 6 gets updated to the latest version by running Apple's updater. And even after you install Oracle's version of Java, the control panel goes away, but Java SE 6 is still there, even though you've just now installed Java SE 7, and by default, the operating system will now use that over Java SE 6. And you can actually see that Apple's runtime is still there by going into your system folder, into the library folder under Java, and looking at the Java virtual machines, and you'll very likely see a file there that says 1.6.0.jdk. And that is the older version of the runtime. The one nice thing about Apple's version of the preferences was that you could go in and you could enable or disable whatever version you want. So if you wanted Java SE 6, you could have that enabled and turn off Java SE 7 or vice versa. Now with this new model, it's always going to use whatever the latest and greatest version of Java you have installed, even though you might have other versions, which is probably the case if you've updated to the latest version of Java from Oracle. Now, I don't think you have yet, John, and it sounds like what you were looking to do was just remove the old virtual machine. So again, you'll find it in System Library Java under Java Virtual Machines. So if you needed to, I guess you could go in there and manually delete that file. I don't know if I would recommend doing that. I didn't have a chance to look and see if Oracle offered or if Apple offered any kind of Java uninstaller. But if there is something like that, you might want to try and find that and use that to remove an old variant of Java. But I'd even be more concerned because I think the whole genesis for this was you were saying that you had Java running on your system and it was using up a lot of processor resources, something like 150%, and you just wanted to sort of kill it off. But I would question, why is it using that? You may have an application that's running in the background that relies on Java being there. The one I could specifically think of in the case of my system is I use CrashPlan to do my online backups, and CrashPlan does use Java. And I just want to mention something to anybody who might be considering going out and getting Oracle's version of Java. Java SE 7 or 1.7 is the version number. Crash Plan still requires, if you use it, that you have the older version of Java installed. And so if you do upgrade to Oracle's Java, you might find that Crash Plan is no longer working. They actually have a support article for that. You can go in and edit the plist file using some terminal commands and update it to point at the older version of Java, the SE6 version, even after you've upgraded to version 7 under macOS 10.7 or later. So I'll have a link to how to do that in the show notes at maccast.com in case you've run into that problem, but just a little caveat to be aware of. And I guess in closing, the main things to take away from this are, if you've run that Java update recently, you might not have the preferences application anymore. And if you use some Java applications, you might want to be careful about upgrading, because the operating system is always going to use the latest version you have installed, and all of your Java applications might not be compatible with that latest version. So just another thing to think about and worry about. So John, I hope that gives you some additional information and helps you figure out how to get Java off of your system. And then finally for today, I have a comment from Richard, and I thought this was great. It's actually something that I've known about, I think, some people know about, and maybe not everybody knows about. And it's a way to actually, for some folks, save some money on your Apple purchases.
Hi, Adam. I just wanted to mention quick about people that can qualify for either the government employee discount or the education discount or military discount on the Apple Store. You may note that there is a $200 discount off of the Retina MacBook Pro, the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro, but the 13-inch MacBook Pro only gets a $100 discount. So when you apply the discounts to them, there ends up only being a $100 difference between the two. I haven't heard much talk lately about the specialty stores for the discounts, but it's just something I came across and thought I would pass it along. Love the show. Thanks for doing it.
Hey, thanks, Richard. And let's correct not talking about these educational and government discounts. It's something that I think, if you're in that world, you may or may not know about, but outside of that world, a lot of people don't. And it's something we probably should share with each other more often. So I want to thank you for sending in your comment. Yeah, you can find links to those stores. If you go to Apple's online store page and look there over in the right-hand column, you'll see a section or a little area called More Stores, and you'll see the links to the educational store as well as the government store. And if you are a college student, a parent buying for a college student, a teacher, a homeschool teacher, an administrator, even staff at any grade level, you can qualify for those educational discounts and the educational pricing. Similarly, if you want the government discount, if you're a federal, state, or local government employee, or if you're military personnel or family of military personnel, you can qualify for the government discounts that Apple offers. And you can go in and you can browse those stores and see the pricing that is available. And very often, as Richard noted, depending on the specific product that you're looking for, you can get savings as high as a couple $100. It looks like right now, you know, things like the iPad mini and the new iPad, those aren't discounted. I think I was poking around in there, I think you get like a $20 discount on the Mac mini. But, you know, if you're going to go buy a new iMac, you might save $100-$200, which can be a significant discount for a lot of folks. So well worth looking into if you qualify for it. And thanks, Richard, for reminding us of those. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can get more information on all of their great applications as well as details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, hey, if you want to buy one of those great new iOS devices, maybe a new iPad mini, you might want to check out Gazelle. You can get cash for your old Mac, your iOS devices, even your Android smartphones. You can get a free quote as well as more information over at gazelle.com. and Citrix. GoToMeeting with HD Faces, the best way to meet and collaborate online. You can try it free yourself for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. A big thank you to you for your support. If you have any questions for me, any comments, anything you'd like to know about, please send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MACCAST. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you can find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/maccast, or be sure to check out the MACCAST Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.